And I want to start out by asking questions of you. And there's no right or wrong to these questions, and you can raise, I will ask you to raise your hand, and you can raise it multiple times, right? So the question I want to start out with is, what brought you to meditation? And I have a list of things, so just raise your hand, and we'll just get a sense of what it's like. How many came to meditation out of curiosity? All right. And how many people came to meditation because they were inspired by a teacher? And how many who were interested in getting enlightened? They had a passion to get enlightened. Wow. Oh-ho. And how about how many people came to meditation because they were under stress and wanted to learn how to relax? All right. That's usually most reason people come. And then the more intense one, how many people came to meditation because they were unhappy and wanted to address their unhappiness? All right. Yeah, there are other reasons. Community, because others you knew who were doing it. I mean, when I taught meditation to university students, a lot of people came because their roommate said, you have to take that class. And usually the roommate was right. They were really good students in the class. So I bumped into a friend who had been ordained a monk in an Ajahn Chah monastery, and we'll talk a little bit about Ajahn Chah later in Thailand. And when I told him about the subject of my book, he responded, I couldn't do that. I love my comforts too much. And I submitted an article to a magazine, again about forest practice, and the editor replied, and this is literally his reply, as a meditator, I enjoyed your book, but the idea of meditating in the wild doesn't resonate with my Western body or lifestyle. Someone else, who was scared of the prospects of sitting with wild creatures, peppered me with questions about my encounters with bears when I sat, with this kind of intensity. Did they come up and touch you? Were you scared, etc.? So when I talk about forest practice, it's not as if it's a challenge to you that somehow, commuting to work, having air conditioning at home, watching television is some lesser value. And if you don't live up to the standards of the challenges that forest meditators took, that somehow you're missing the point. It's very much like all the different reasons people are drawn to meditation. For some, like me, there's something about nature in the wild that was compelling, and I feel at home there. And that doesn't mean that somehow your practice is any less because you do it in a dark room in a monastery and you really want to concentrate and someone brings you your meal every day. These are different practices for people with different dispositions. And it's very important in meditation practice over the years as you do it to understand the nature of your own disposition. Because when you begin to understand that, it doesn't mean you don't explore the boundaries of it. It doesn't mean that you don't take on challenges. But at some time in practice, and this may change because life is always throwing up new things to us, there's a kind of settling in, and you learn, this is the way I relate to practice. And for some of us, it's sitting outdoors. So, I sort of wanted to say an anecdote. I can't tell you how many loving kindness retreats I've sat, How many people here likes to do metta meditation, find it really enriching? Right. Anyway, it's not my practice. I've done it for years. Kind of not my thing, even though I do it over and over again. And I do the practice every day now, but I was challenged to do that about 6 years ago. Why it is not my thing would take us far away from the subject of the talk. But it's interesting to confront that, because people will come up to me and say, how come you don't do loving kindness? Or how come you know, the results that I get from loving kindness meditation don't happen to you? And I have to say, hey, you know, it's not how I'm oriented in the world. And it's not that I'm not compassionate, but that's obviously for other people to judge. But that kind of practice does not really speak deeply to me. So, but sitting in nature does. And again, this is no value judgment. And I think sitting in nature has something to teach us, even if you're not drawn to it, that's really obscured by the world we live in. In other words, we live in a world with a great deal of comfort and with a great deal of distraction, and somehow walking away from that can be an important ingredient to understand ourselves and also what all that does to us. And I think at this point in our society, that is a real challenge, to look into the busyness, to look into the cell phones, to look into the computers, to look into the sense of, that we need a certain level of material comfort, to look into the politics of the world we live in. Those are very important challenges, and they're really part of meditation. So if we go back to the Buddha, the time of the Buddha and the Buddha's activities, we find that in some sense he was the original forest monk. It's pretty clear, and now we're going back 2,500 years, it's pretty clear that there were people in the forests of India at the time of the Buddha that were doing all kinds of practices. Some of them were meditation practices. Some of them were Vedic rituals. The origins of Hinduism go back way before Buddhism started, although Hinduism is really of quite recent religion, although they claim a kind of antiquity, which is not really the case. And most religions claim a lot more from their past than can really be established historically. So at the time of the Buddha, there were guys and women wandering around the jungles of India doing various things. And in some sense, the earliest indications of forest practice we have were of women. There is something called the Poems of the Elder Nuns. There is linguistic evidence that whatever they were doing it in a time before the Buddha. And that when Buddhism came along, their sayings got rewritten as if they were part of Buddhist tradition. Now, who cares in a way? But it's an interesting fact. And then the monks came along and forbade the women to go off in the forest. Because the claim was they might be physically harmed. But then we know about religions and we know about patriarchy. So women pretty much disappear from forest practice, although there are contemporary women who have gone back to do some versions of it. And one of the reasons why the women went into the jungle, and if you read the Poems of the Elder Nuns, it's really interesting. Mostly it was because of the death of children and the unbelievable suffering that arose from the death of their children. And they declared the suffering was so great that they could not contain it within the cultured or the civilized world, which was agricultural at that time, in which they were. And so they went off into the woods to meditate. And their poems are quite interesting. But unfortunately, female participation in this tradition, except a little bit in Zen in China and Japan, vanishes. So, what did the Buddha do? He was in his pleasure palace, as the story goes in the sutras, and these are stories. We have no idea of the actual truth of it, or even of the existence of the Buddha, even though Buddhism would claim a certain literalness to the sutras. There's no independent evidence. Buddhism could have been made up 250 years after the Buddha was supposed to be born by scholars in the reign of Asoka. But in some sense, it doesn't matter, because what we want to extract from those sutras is what's relevant for us today. And there's a great deal there. So the Buddha was there in his pleasure palaces, and there was a prediction that he would turn down the kingship if he ever was exposed to the world. And so his papa kept him immersed in whatever it was at this time you could have by way of pleasure and entertainment. And, you know, what the sutras offer as a story of that doesn't work, because the Buddha's time was pretty primitive. There were no palaces, and there were hardly towns if the Buddha did live in the time that the sutras claim. But nonetheless, it's a great story. You know, keep him ignorant of the world, and he will become a great king. But the Buddha was restless with that, and he went out, he snuck out of the palace, and saw disease, old age, and death, and renunciate, and decided that he could not be satisfied with the pleasures of his life if disease, old age, and death were inevitable. He could not hold on to his pleasures. He would lose those that he loved. And as a subtext, those pleasures, when you looked at them very closely, were ultimately unsatisfactory. And here was the wild-haired Brahmin. We have no idea, a bald-haired monk. And the Buddha was told this was the way to go beyond the suffering that life inevitably imposes on people. And he went off in the jungles to do it, or the dryland jungle or dryland forests of India at the time. And this became an archetype for practice. And he did all kinds of extreme practices, and they didn't work for him. And one day he sat down beneath a Bodhi tree and vowed not to move until he was enlightened. And he was offered milk, which has a great symbol in it. And he sat there. And while he sat there, he was tempted by Mara. Mara is this great kind of devilish character within Buddhism. And Mara said, "Hey, Buddha, what makes you think you have the right to sit here?" And the Buddha makes this gesture. I don't think I can do the gesture, but he essentially places his hand on the earth, and he says, "The earth is a witness to the sincerity of my efforts." And with that, Mara, or doubt, or temptation, was banished. And the Buddha became aware, awakened. Right? So we have this model of leaving the things that are comfortable to us, and also relationship. Right? And this is implicit, there's something in relationship that is also a delusion. Now, for us in the contemporary world, that's a real challenge, because relationship is very high on many of our scales of what makes life worthwhile, right? And it's interesting to follow the forest tradition and see how they deal with relationship, because to a great extent, it's a solitary tradition. And in that way, it may be lacking something. In that way, it may miss something that we need to speak to us. And I'll just leave that out as a question. In the earliest Sangha, there weren't many people who were forest renunciants, as they were called in the early days. The Buddha apparently gave a discourse, and in which I would love to give that discourse here. He held up a flower, said nothing. It's really an easy one. And presumably only one person understood, a monk by the name of Mahakashyapa, and he smiled. And that was it. That was his awakening. And that was the foundation of Zen. And Zen is essentially a practice, has its, at its heart the non-discursive transmission of understanding, or the non-discursive transmission of awakening. And Zen does it in many different ways. It, you know, in Rinzai Zen, it's koans. You know, what is the sound of one hand clapping? In Soto Zen, it's just sitting, right? Just sitting. And of course, there are many elaborations around these things. This is kind of the heart of it. And in some way, forest practice sits more comfortably in Zen as we look at it than it does in Theravada. So let's go back to the Buddha now. Clearly at the time of the, well, clearly at the time, not very clearly, quite murkily at the time of the Buddha, there were people who went off into the woods to practice. There were people who were townspeople. And we think the earliest monasteries, and this would be a considerable time before Asoka, when Buddhism became a really distinct formed religion. In fact, the first world religion. And Asoka was a great conqueror of India, although he's claimed to have been a pacifist. But with him, Buddhism spread. Before him, we know very little historically about Buddhism. After him, we find the people who were more monastic, more scholarly, were associated with merchants, and they traveled with the merchants all around India, into Sri Lanka, into China, into Southeast Asia. So in the very early days, we see the kind of bifurcation of style, right? There were those who were more comfortable in town and sat on porches and walked in parks, what were called parks then. And there are sutras in the sacred texts that say in such and such a park the Buddha gathered, and you know, it indicates there were tens of thousands of people, highly unlikely, but still it was parks. And they hung out on the porches. And I don't know why porches, but that comes up in the history of it. And then there were those that went off into the forest, but forest practice wasn't for everyone. And here we have to, here I have to kind of wonder about which direction I'm going in, because as a professor, and I love scholarly things like history, but I'm also somewhat of a forest monk, maybe not the monk part, but a forest practitioner. And my life has been filled with unusual things that have happened in that practice. And, you know, so I think I want to try and bounce back and forth between the two. First, I'd like to talk a little bit about forest practice and see if I can find the quotes, which don't seem to be here, but they're here. Okay. So the Buddha recommended forest practice to people. He said that it was good to go off in the woods because there was little that would distract you, and you could perfect your practice there. In other words, the things that distract, like family obligation, relationship, entertainment, alcohol, what have you, didn't exist there. And so it was a great container to really pursue meditation. But he also said that that unbridled imagination could lead you astray, and that a person would be unable to appreciate the solitude. The wilderness would whirl away his mind. Now, if you go off into the woods to sit, you'll find, in fact, that's the case, that it's very challenging. There's not much going on, right? And what's going on are things that we're not really attuned to. At the time of the Buddha, the people of the Buddha's society lived on the edge of the forest. And in most peasant cultures, and certainly many I've been in, people are terrified of the untamed. And this was true of villagers in Thailand up until, say, the 1960s, the Vietnam War, when Thailand, parts of Thailand and Laos and Cambodia and Burma were still pretty wild. Villagers did not go off into the woods, except a few. There were the hunters and the gatherers of herbs and medicinal things. Otherwise, they were scary places for villagers. And so here is the Buddha saying, just like when we began in looking about how you're drawn to meditation practice, if the woods whirled away your mind, that was not a good way to practice. It was, you know, not a kind of wise means of meditating. But then there were those who were the specialists in it. And we know they existed at the time of the Buddha. We have very little evidence of what they did. A few well-known ones are mentioned in the sutras, and one was a person expelled from the Sangha early on, a guy by the name of Devadatta. And it is clear that Devadatta, although he may have wandered from the basic ideas of Buddhism, something about either the shamanistic nature or the intensity of his practice made him threatening to the Sangha. And he's the first person that was expelled, and he was expelled for splitting the Sangha. So here we have religion again. You know, I mean, Buddhism is a religion. Certainly every religion is filled with things like that. In Buddhism, because it's not hierarchical and church-like, those things happen, but they don't get talked about very much. They are not conveyed in the lore. There are these kind of hidden ways. I mean, we know there have been some very intense sectarian things in Tibetan Buddhism, but how many of us, even though we've heard about them, know about their content there, which is a more church-like structure? They keep them hidden. In Theravadan Zen, they're just kind of smoothed over. Anyway, so we know there was forest practice at the time of the Buddha. We know that the Buddha talked about it. And we know that as Buddhism spread, that this subtext, this little thin thread of forest practice, kept popping up. Right? It popped up in China in a particularly Chinese way Early Buddhism was particularly Indian, and a wonderful thing about Buddhism is it adapts to the cultures in which it's been transported. After all, there are many people in this room that they say they're Buddhists, but you wouldn't much look like what was a real Buddhist in ancient India. It would have a very different flavor to it. In China, it was very different from India. First of all, Taoism existed in China, which had a taste of nature in it. Also, Confucianism existed in China. And Confucianism is the great religion of family and state and order and responsibility, right? And Taoism, which was kind of, you know, go with the flow, was the counterbalance of that in Chinese society. And, you know, the Tao Te Ching and Lao Tzu, we don't really know very much about. In fact, it's hard to know what that ancient Chinese meant, but it's very suggestive. In other words, the way we read it it sounds a lot like our ideas of nature, though in China it was used a little differently. It was used first to live forever, called esoteric Taoism, right? And how many emperors injected mercury into their veins because their acupuncturist suggested that's how they would gain mortality? We don't know. But acupuncture came out of it, and certainly the Chinese were healers way before anybody else, in a way. There were Chinese pharmacopoeias 3,000 years ago when the Indians, none of them could read. But there was a magical side to Taoism. But there was also a side to Taoism that said, hey, there is something wrong with the claims of the Confucius state. There's something unnatural about it. And it posed a poetry of nature. Well, Buddhism came along, and that poetry fit beautifully with Buddhism. And so, particularly in Chan, the antecedent of Zen, rocks now had Buddha nature. That was not true in ancient India. And recluses went off into the woods to be at one with nature. And we have more evidence of them, in part because China was a vastly more literate society, and in part because they left evidence of what they did as poems inscribed on logs, as ink paintings, and some of the characters in China were very mythical, but nonetheless those poems are there, although we don't know really how they got passed down and where they came from. So I want to read a couple of poems. I want to read a poem from Cold Mountain, my favorite. And all of you who know Gary Snyder as a poet know that he's translated a lot of these. Gary Snyder has as close a sense of forest monasticism in him as anybody does, even though he was very much a homemaker and lived in a community too. But there's something in his relationship with nature that resonates deeply with forest practice, and that's conveyed a lot in his poetry. So here is Cold Mountain. If you are looking for a place to rest, Cold Mountain is good for a long stay. The breeze blowing through the dark pines sounds better the closer you come. And under the trees, a white-haired man mumbles over his Taoist texts. 10 years now, he hasn't gone home. He's even forgotten the road he came by. Men ask the way to Cold Mountain. Cold Mountain was also the name of the people got named for the mountains they lived on. Men ask the way to Cold Mountain. Cold Mountain, there's no through trail. In summer, ice doesn't melt. The rising sun blurs in swirling fog. How did I make it? My heart's not the same as yours. If your heart was like mine, you'd get it and be right here. Cold Mountain had a buddy by the name of Pickup. Cold Mountain lived on a mountain in China called Cold Mountain. Pickup was the janitor in the nearby monastery. And there are wonderful pictures of the two of them. Cold Mountain would come down to get scraps of food, which presumably Pickup saved for him. And Cold Mountain would be, you know, the Laughing Buddha. He kind of looks like the Laughing Buddha in some of the pictures with straw sandals on, jumping up the air and clicking his heels. And Pickup is a skinny guy, and he's got a broom, and he's sweeping. And what he did was Cold Mountain came down and mocked the monks, and Pickup swept them out of the monastery. So there is a real image when we come to China of rebels, right, who didn't fit in anywhere, who had wild, who had a lot of wildness in them, and who lived in the wild. And there are marvelous poems about sitting and listening to monkeys. There are other poems about tigers. If we go back to India, or we'll come back to an Indian kind of practice, there's stuff about elephants and insects and stuff like this. And this became the material of people's practice, of living with the seasons, with the cold, with the rain, eating very primitive food. In Theravada, in ancient India, the monks begged, but begging did not fit with Chinese culture. So the monks who went off into the mountains, or the recluses, had gardens, and they collected wild herbs. They were very good at it. For Theravadan monks, you usually walked for 4 days. You could go for 4 days without food, but then you had to find a place to beg for your meals. And if any of you have been here when some of the Theravadan monks come, you get a ritualized version of that. And some of them that live up in the town of White Salmon, Washington, go walking down in this nearby, totally working class town on the Columbia River with closed car repair shops and a couple of McDonald's hamburgers, and they go on their arms round every day. And I don't know what percentage of their food they get, but they are dedicated to that practice. And there's a certain humility in it, in the asceticism of it. And that humility was taken to a greater extreme in the forest. Right? So that in China, you had a relation, in India, you had a relationship to the community, and you staked your life on that relationship. You also staked your life on going into the wilds. In China, it was more kind of, I can't say agricultural, but it was more connected to nature, because in a sense you collected the wild herbs and you had a little garden, and your practice focused on the fact that everything had Buddha nature. And in Theravada Buddhism, compassion only applies to sentient beings, and they have a highly technical sense of sentient. And there's something to that. You know, there's something to that. Where does an insect sit on that? And what is it like when you sit with insects? I sat a retreat in 1970-something with a man named Dhiravamsa, a wonderful kind of trickster of a man, who'd been a Thai monk for 24 years and very high in the hierarchy until he came west and, according to the Thais, lost his way. But he was a provocative teacher, and we were doing this retreat in a Jewish summer camp in southern New Hampshire, right? And before the camp had started, there was no connection to the Jew. He just rented the facility for whatever. And we never knew how long we were going to sit. So you would sit, and Dira could really get into sitting. He had wonderful, what they call samadhi. You would open your eyes during the retreat and see him sitting up there, and it would be like he was glowing and with complete composure. And I don't ever think he knew how long we were going to sit. He just sat, and when it was over, it was over. So one day he had us sitting, and this is what you call tough practice. He had us sitting in the sun on a tennis court, right? And we sat, we had to take a vow we wouldn't move. And we sat for 3 hours. I mean, that was torture, absolute torture. We were not allowed to kill anything, no killing, literally no killing. And so we couldn't brush mosquitoes away, nor could we wear repellent, because it was uncompassionate to wear repellent. If the mosquito didn't bite me, right, it would bite somebody else. So although Dhiravamsa was not a forest monk by any measure of the, by any measure whatsoever, he was a highly educated monk from Bangkok and no longer a monk when I sat with him. And we sat one evening in the cabin, in one of these cabins. You know, it had screens, but it made no difference. In southern New Hampshire in June. And I sat there, again, the vow of not to move, no repellent, and I counted the mosquitoes as they bit me, all right? And if you can really pay attention to a mosquito, it's no longer quite so easy, right? And so you sit there, and the mosquito buzzes around, you hear it, right? And your body is like going like this, but you go, you know, loving kindness, whatever, to your body. And the mosquito, concentrate on your breath, nothing else exists, in and out. And this mosquito lands on, and you can feel it walking around. And if you really feel it, it's exquisitely sensual. And it is so sensual that you can barely sit there, or at least I can barely sit there. And then nothing. You don't feel anything because you don't feel a stinger going in. They actually have a little bit of like Novocaine in that toxin. And then you feel the mosquito moving and going away, and then it begins. Right? The itching and the stinging of it, it begins. And so we're sitting there, who knows, 20 minutes, an hour, 2.5 hours, I don't know. And I'm sitting doing Dhiravamsa's practice, right? Trying not to curse him in my mind. When is this going to be over? And 20 bites, 21st bite, the mosquito lands on my lips. And I go, oh, no. You know, what is existence asking of me? And essentially, I watch it bite, I feel it go away, and the bell rings, right? And for many years after that, I did not slap a mosquito for, I don't know, 10, 15 years. I wore repellent because I worked a lot in the bush and stuff like that, and I've been places where you could hardly see there were so many bugs, but I didn't slap a mosquito. And you know, I just didn't do it. Good, bad, I'm morally superior, no way. Was it an example of non-killing? You know, somehow I was obeying the precept non-killing. I wouldn't claim that kind of moral superiority. I just didn't slap a mosquito. And then when, you know, the disease, mosquito-borne diseases began to reappear, I began slapping mosquitoes again. I would not let a mosquito bite me. I mean, I'd brush mosquitoes off. And somehow that kind of experience, although Dhiravamsa was not presenting that day, became part of what forest practice was about. Now, if you read, and I should bring this to a close soon. If you read about, say, the forest monks in Thailand, and there was a whole flowering of forest monasticism in the late 19th century in Thailand. It went to China. There were people like Cold Mountain in China. It went to Japan. And if you've, any of you have read the poetry of Ryokan, you spend any time outdoors, you know this man was an authentic forest monk. No one could have written, or they were called hermits, Zen hermits in Japan, no one who didn't understand nature and live there could have written what he wrote. And that, for me, was a criteria of telling who was authentic in this history and who wasn't. Right? I mean, and because I had done a great deal of it. And when you read them, you know, oh, come on. And unfortunately, the greatest Zen poet of all, Basho, who will be quoted a great deal, was, oh, come on. It was really astounding to discover that he was a con man. He was a great poet, but he didn't do forest practice. He wrote beautiful nature poetry. And he admits it himself. I mean, he doesn't admit it, but if you read his journals, you discover it. And it was interesting to see that, to figure out the value of my own experience and how I could use it to figure out who did it and who played at it. And, I was greatly disappointed when I went into Chinese paintings of the supposed recluses in China and found that they were really very cultured people with a great deal of money and lived on estates, and they took the pose of forest practice because it was the Taoist answer to the discontent of the obligations a society placed on you. And they were great at it, and their paintings are wonderful, but they're not authentic practice. So there's a lot of myths about forest practitioners. And one of the myths is that somehow their great karma, because they're so compassionate, insulated them against the dangers of living in the woods. Now, it's a great idea, and maybe I have accumulated a lot of great karma and I have done a lot of meditation practice, and bears are not going to eat me, but there would be no point in doing it if that were the case. There would be no point in stepping out of civilization and going into a situation where you confront life or death without any protection in order to learn about what it means to be human and your own discontent if I were protected against it. And in fact, what I know of the forest practitioners of Thailand and Southeast Asia, they did die. They got bitten by snakes. They got tromped by elephants. They sat there with ants crawling over all of them at night because they took a vow not to move until the sun came up. They faced their fears directly. Mahabua, one of the most profound of the Thai forest monks, had this little epigram, and I think I'll end with that. It is that fear drives samadhi or concentration to insight. So most of the practitioners who went in the woods had a very solid meditation practice that they developed in a monastic setting. And for me, it was years in meditation centers, and I wouldn't say mine was solid the way theirs were, Because if you go in the woods without it, you might have a great time and you might enjoy yourself, but to do practice there without that is really to have your mind whirled away. So if you take that practice and you go into a setting where it's life or death, where there is nobody to hug you, and by God, that's not fun, right? Where there is no screen to keep the mosquitoes out, where something can actually hurt you. And I don't recommend that you do that. I mean, we live in Marin, and no mountain lion is going to eat you while you're meditating, unless you're really little, because they attack things that move, right? And the coyotes won't bother you. And, you know, you might get sprayed by a skunk that doesn't like your presence, but it's no threat to you. But for the forest monks, in the settings in which they lived, they took on that challenge of life or death in order to conquer their own discontent, their own suffering. And so to have myths about them, that they somehow transcended it, is to take away the real part of the practice. And I sat an hour or two in my backyard, right, in Woodacre, right? What do I have to worry about? There was a deer kill in my backyard a couple of years ago, and whether it was a mountain lion or coyotes or feral dogs, I don't know. But there was that dead deer, all the bones in my yard. And it never occurs to me that anybody will harm me there, but who knows? And I listened to the birds. And I find it a deeply satisfying thing. It's also unbelievably unstimulating at some level, right? It's boring. It happens year after year. At this time, the birds begin, the bird song begins to diminish. There are the crows, of course, you know, the busybodies are out there. But those beautiful birds that sing these lovely songs, there's only one or two of them left. And there's a Pacific slope flycatcher who's decided to make a nest on my doorway, right? Every time I walk out the door, she's out of the nest. And I thought the eggs were dead in the nest. And I wish she'd go away, but I think she's genuinely mentally challenged, because she's still there almost a month later. And now we sit and we converse. This morning she was on a chair, and I think there was another little beak in the nest. So my God, there may be offspring there. I've been discounting her. But she sits on a chair about, oh, that far away from me, looking at the nest, not going up there when I'm there. She would not feed her young when I was there, because if she did that when a bird was present, the crows or the jays would take her young in no time. And I look at her, and we sit there together, and she's gorgeous with her little olive eye, and she looks at me, and I have no idea what's in her mind, right? Absolutely none. That she tolerates my presence at that distance is, I regard, a great gift, right? It says something about, okay, I'm in this world with you too. We both have Buddha nature, whatever that might be. And for my disposition, that feeds my practice. Does it make me happy? Maybe. It calms my spirit when the things that make me unhappy arise, and so I can deal with them a little better. It also gives me a great question mark about the society we have produced and the values in it. Somehow there's a lot of it that seems out of whack with what we are as animals in this existence. And I don't have a magic wand to do anything about it, but I observe it and maybe moderate my behaviors in a way to reduce it. So let's leave it there. And any questions at all? Sure.
Earlier in the talk, you talked about the forest practitioners who were women, and how when Buddhism came along, what they had to say was sort of melded into that, but that didn't matter. I'm just curious, maybe I didn't understand you correctly, but I'm wondering if you can say more, because I found myself thinking it does matter that they, what they were saying wasn't, was sort of dismissed.
No, it wasn't dismissed. What it was given a Buddhist coding. In other words, they became kind of followers of the Buddha, and they weren't likely followers of the Buddha. Their message is still clear. It wasn't covered over about the nature of the suffering they experienced and the use of meditation practice to address it. It's just that women were then excluded from that set of techniques afterwards. So they were not diminished in terms of their insights, right? They were just not allowed to, other women were not allowed to take them as models. And so that's where the patriarchy in Buddhism was. So does that answer your question?
Yeah, I just didn't fully understand what you meant when you said it didn't matter. I found myself...
Well, it didn't matter because their message came through. That they were then saying, oh, the Buddha is wonderful, and, you know, and we're this and that. It didn't really matter because when you read them, they will touch your heart. You will understand why it is that, you know, and women are somewhat more civilized than men. Not true, but the natural challenges of a female body are somewhat greater than for a male body. And so what civilization has to offer may be more welcome. And of the three people at the end of my book who go off and do nature practice, two of them are women. And they're really interesting women, you know. And it's really interesting to, they're very different, to look at their confrontation, or they're not confrontation, they're going out in nature and what the challenges are. You know, and those who read, of course, Mary Oliver, know that there's a lot of expression of women in nature that is absolutely wonderful. Yeah.
There's a really funny line Woody Allen in one of the movies. He says, I don't want to go into nature. I'm at two with nature.
At which?
I'm at two with nature.
At two?
No, at one.
Oh, sorry. I don't get Woody Allen. Anyway, what's your point? Well, I mean, he doesn't even want to ride in a convertible in Los Angeles.
It kind of sums up that sensibility of a modern man or Western man. And I think, for me, it's clear if we think of not so much nature as the natural world. Woody may, in fact, with the natural world, but it requires a real leap of faith and consciousness to become aware of that. The forest is a nature as we, you know, it is, you know, it's great, sure, you know, it's part of the natural world, and it gives us a little hint as to the things in there which are pristine and authentic.
Yes. No, we do want to. I mean, what is meditation practice except finding authenticity, right? And there are parts of ourselves we don't know. There are parts of ourselves that emerge in meditation practice. I mean, we are animals, and we don't fit together as well as we imagine we do. Ryo Kan's last poem is beautiful. It's a metaphorical poem using natural images about the wildness of the human mind and body. And what does it mean to really encounter those? All right, now certainly there's no lack of encountering it up in the meditation hall up there. Right? You sit for any length of time, and I've done very long retreats. I've done retreats that are long. And in them can be quite a ride from everything from quite ecstatic to, you know, the depths of one's suffering. Nature or the wild places are a way to get a greater sense of what kind of an animal we are, right? And how we exist with these other beings on the world. You know, how we said, I mean, that Pacific slope flycatcher is a mystery, and yet she's not. Those of you who have been parents, if you watch, say, barn swallows or cliff swallows that like to hang out in buildings, there used to be run right at the entrance a barn swallow. As you opened the door of the Insight Meditation Society, there was a barn swallow nest. And when they were feeding their young, it was like they were insane. I mean, you know, the 200 or 300 times an hour, they would come back with insects. I mean, like driven by hormones that if you feel that in you, you have some understanding of how we're part of nature. They just do it maybe a little more extremely than we do, but maybe not. That's why the flycatcher is a puzzle to me. I don't understand her maternity in this context. It strikes me there's something out of balance there. Well, maybe there's a teaching in it. Maybe there's a kind of patience in her that's very different from the barn swallows in the Insight Meditation Society. I mean, I remember on a retreat opening the door, and it's like you were in an insane asylum. These birds were just like frantic. You know, this couple going one nest and going back and forth. And you know how swallows fly. They're just quick and they dart around like this. Okay, other questions? Yeah. Well, Jack is a student of Ajahn Chah. Ajahn Chah was a famous forest monk. So clearly some of the spirit that was brought to Spirit Rock comes from the forest tradition, even if it's not explicit. I sat with Ajahn Chah in 1978 at the Insight Meditation Society, and Jack was there as his translator. He gave an absolutely wonderful Dharma talk. He and Ajahn Chah had gone for a walk in the afternoon, and Ajahn Chah's a trickster, came back and looked at Jack and said, "I'm too tired, you give the Dharma talk." And so Jack talked about his time off the cuff, about his time in Thailand with Ajahn Chah. And I do have a tape recording of it. I don't know if it exists anywhere else. So there is some essence that has been brought down here. I think what has happened is the forest monks like Ajahn Chah who settled, very few of them conveyed what it was like to be in the woods to their students. And I don't mean to be impolite when I say this, but Ajahn Chah felt that his Western students had stupid feet, and because they were always cutting themselves and stubbing their toes, walking barefoot or with sandals in the woods, and it would be dangerous for them to send them off into the woods. Besides, the time that Jack got to Thailand, or Sumedho got to Thailand, the forest tradition was over. The Vietnam War was going on, the Thai military dictatorship was playing was hand in glove with the Americans. The two things were happening. One is that the Thai military regarded the monks as potentially communists and swept them out of the jungles. Three things were happening. AID was spraying the roadsides with Agent Orange, so the guerrillas in Thailand would have no place to hide, with very toxic results. And the major American Air Force base was Tansanit Air Force Base in Thailand. And the B-52s that were bombing the Ho Chi Minh Trail would take off, fly to Laos, Cambodia, and Vietnam, drop their bombs. And on the way back, if there were any bombs in the plane, they would release them in the jungles. So it was a dangerous place to be. End of tradition, not conveyed to the next generation, except maybe by a forest monk named Mahabua, or except as parables by a guy named Ajahn Jumnian, who used to come to Spirit Rock. And so the tradition vanished. The meat of it, but maybe the essence of it, is what made up the things that Ajahn Chah conveyed to Jack and then have conveyed to us, even though the stories and the tales that went along with it are not there. And it's maybe more appropriate for our times, and it was more Jack's disposition. Certainly Ajahn Sumedho would have loved to go off in the forest, but Ajahn Chah wouldn't let him. Made him head of a monastery in England, because Ajahn Chah always challenged his monks to do what was the hardest for him. As for myself, I started sitting in the woods in New England. I lived 30 miles from the Insight Meditation Society. New England is very wooded, and that's where I like to sit. And I did it for years. I didn't understand what Ajahn Chah, being a forest monk, was, although I was deeply touched by him. And I just got more and more in it, and I started to do long retreats in the woods. And then I started to sit up in northern Canada with wild animals. And I have a certain, bears seem to have an affinity, so there are tales of my encounters with bears in northern Canada while I was meditating. When I got interested in writing this book, I discovered there was a forest tradition that I had known nothing about. And then I really got into it and had a great time. It was about 10 years of doing research, and I had a great time doing it. Anyway, why don't we take one last question, if there is one? Otherwise, we'll call it a day. Well, may you sit in your yards. May you go to the parks of Marin, which are beautiful. Limantur Beach in the dunes. You can get a perfect slant so your back is erect sitting on the sand. Wonderful places to sit. Try it. See if it appeals to you. If it doesn't, that's fine. So thank you very much.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.